You can turn to Exodus chapter 17. Got a couple more to do in Exodus before I switch gears, but I did not get finished. I want to give you a little story this morning that comes from one of Tony Campolo's books. It's a true story. I really like true stories. The Lord works in great and mysterious ways. This one comes to us from something that happened way back in the fourth grade to a man by the name of Teddy Stollard. He had a teacher, Miss Thompson, in the fourth grade. Now, Teddy was kind of slow and unmotivated, an unkempt type of youngster, a loner, kind of ignored by his classmates. He didn't stand out in any way in particular. The previous year, his mother had died. And what little motivation that Teddy had for school seemed to be completely gone. Miss Thompson didn't particularly like Teddy. He didn't seem to be particularly happy about being in school. But Christmas time came that year, fourth grade. The desk of the teacher was covered with well-wrapped presents brought to her by her students. That is, all except for one present. It wasn't wrapped at all. It was just a brown paper bag. When she got down to the paper bag, she opened it, and there was a rhinestone bracelet inside that had some missing parts and wasn't really that pretty. And a bottle of cheap perfume. The children in the class began to snicker as Miss Thompson opened that bag, and the teacher realized the significance of the moment. So she quickly splashed some of that cheap perfume on her face and put on the bracelet and indicated how special they were by her actions. The class quieted down. At the end of the day, Teddy walked up to her and softly said, "Miss Thompson, you smell just like my mother. And her bracelet looks real pretty on you, too. I'm glad you like my presents." Well, after Teddy left, Miss Thompson got down on her knees and prayed God to forgive her for her attitude toward Teddy prior to that. She prayed to God that God would use her to teach children and encourage children ever after. Well, a number of years went by, about 8 years, I suppose it was. Teddy had long since moved on. But Miss Thompson got a note around about graduation time. It said, "Dear Miss Thompson, I want you to be the first to know I will be graduating second in my class. Love, Teddy Stollard." 4 more years went by. She got another note. This one said, "Dear Miss Thompson, they just told me I'll be graduating first in my class. I wanted you to be the first to know." Well, 4 years later, another note. "Dear Miss Thompson, as of today, I am Theodore Stollard, medical doctor. How about that? I wanted you to be the first to know. And I want you to know that I'm getting married next month. And I want you to come and sit where my mother would sit if she were alive. You are the only family I have now. Dad died last year. Love, Teddy Stollard." Well, Mrs. Thompson went to the wedding, and she did sit where Teddy's mother would have sat. Only because she was willing to let God use her as an instrument of encouragement in one student's life. Everybody needs a Miss Thompson in their life. In fact, a few Miss Thompsons. And we all need to be a Miss Thompson ourselves. I hope this story reiterates those thoughts and truths in your heart as you think about it. But I want to move on to the scripture, because the question that is now, hopefully, lingering on our hearts and minds is this: well, how do you become an encourager like Miss Thompson did? How can we be that great of an influence, that much of an encouragement in someone else's life? What does it take? Well, the answer is here in these 8 verses or so, beginning in Exodus 17 and verse 8. The Israelites, as you will remember, under the leadership of Moses, have begun the exodus from Egypt. Now, they crossed the Red Sea. If I can get this thing to work. They crossed the Red Sea up here, well into the north of the Gulf, but still in very deep water. And they crossed over onto the Sinai Peninsula, and then they proceeded basically south along the western shore of the Gulf. The first place that they arrived at, after they left the shoreline there where the sea had been parted and then God collapsed it upon the Egyptian army, they went into the wilderness for a while and they ran out of water, and God brought them to this first stop, Marah. And the water was bitter and they complained. And God gave Moses a solution. He threw the branch of the tree in the water and the water became sweet. And then they moved just a few miles south to a place called Elim. There were 12 wells there. It was an oasis with many palm trees, plenty of water. They stayed there for quite a while, and they were within shouting distance of us when they were complaining they didn't have any water, by the way. They thought they were lost in the desert, and they weren't going to make it out, and God knew right where they were at and had them on the right course. But after they did well and things went well and they had plenty in Elim for a while, God moved again. And the cloud and the pillar led them to another spot a little bit further down the line. Although it's not named here specifically in the 17th chapter of Exodus, it's given the broader name of Rephidim in chapter 17, verse 1. We know it's a place called Dophkah. And it was here they needed water again. They didn't have any water. Again, they complained, and this is where God sent them, the elders of the group, at least, with Moses to the rock. And Moses used the staff on the rock, and the water gushed out, and they were supplied. Then in verse 8 of this chapter, again, they're mentioned to be in Rephidim, which is just a tad further down. And here, something significant happens in verse 8. They are attacked by another group of nomads, the nomadic Amalekites. Probably because, and we're not told they are attacked here in Exodus 17, but we know that from reading in Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 and 19, that the Amalekites attacked them. Probably because they were concerned about this huge company of people, over 1 million people, that would be competition for the resources available in that area, which were not great. Or perhaps they just wanted access to the water supply that God had just given them. But the Amalekites attacked. Now, God could have dealt with the Amalekites in a supernatural way, like He had dealt with the Egyptians, and like He had parted the sea, destroyed the armies of Pharaoh. But he does not deal with the Amalekites in such a way. This particular threat, they could meet and handle themselves. Didn't mean that God would not be with them, that God sovereignly wasn't, didn't mean that he wasn't overseeing it and sovereignly was taking care of them. But God wanted them to have a hand in the solution. And for that to take place, for them to stand up militarily to the Amalekites, remember, these were Egyptian slaves. I would guess that almost none of them had any experience with the sword. No experience in the military. So this was a frightening thing, no doubt. But God wanted them to take a hand in their deliverance. It wasn't that he wasn't there. He was. It wasn't that he was going to, you know, somehow forsake them. No, he didn't do that. And so what they needed most of all as they faced this threat, as they were filled with fear and doubt about their own ability, was they needed encouragement. And this is what God supplied them in a big way. And so when we come to chapter 17 of Exodus, verse 8, and we're going to read down through or work down through verse 16, the message that we need to draw from this is very simple. We need to be encouragers. God here himself was the primary encourager, but others were involved as well, as we're going to see. Encouragement is a great need in the lives of people, and I think we all understand that. Because we all get discouraged, and we all have doubts, we all have fears. Encouragement is a commodity that we cannot do without. And I would say this to you. The one thing that we should all strive for is never, ever be a discouragement to another person. But to always be an encouragement to other people. So, how do we become an encourager? How do we, in fact, encourage other people? That's the question we want to deal with as we move through these verses. So I want you to notice with me four ways. I've kind of labeled them the avenues of encouragement. This is the course. This is the road. This is the route. This is how you accomplish encouragement. This is how you move someone from discouragement to trust and faith. Avenue number one. Encourage others by your presence. By your presence. That seems pretty simple. It is. It is simple. It's so simple that sometimes we overlook its importance. Look at verse 8 in Exodus chapter 17. And Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. As we noted earlier, they actually instigated it. And Moses said to Joshua, "Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." Now, in verse 10 it says, "So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek, and Moses and Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill." This group of untested soldiers who is now faced with taking on probably an experienced army, a formidable force, the marches out there to the battle lines are drawn, but Moses is not with them down in the valley. He is up on the mountain in a place where he can be seen. And he goes there with Aaron, his brother, who will eventually become the high priest, and a man by the name of Hur. And he stood at the top of the hill while Joshua, by the way, Joshua never led anybody in battle either. This is his baptism of fire, if you will. And as the two armies are there, Moses is at the top of the hill, and we're specifically told that he's on the top of the hill with the rod of God in his hand. Now we need some reminder here in regard to the rod of God. The rod of God here was an indication and an assurance of God's presence with them. They were not alone. God was on the scene. God was present. And the presence of God reminded them that not only was God present, but God's man was present. Moses was there. And they were reminded of all that God had done for them leading up to this point. The rod or the staff was particularly significant. It was the shepherd's staff of Moses when he spent those 40 years exiled in the desert. Came in handy for the job of a shepherd. It became the symbol of God's authority and power. Remember, God had him throw it down on the ground, it became a snake, and picked it back up, became a rod. It became an instrument of God's judgment. He smote the water with it, and it became blood in Exodus 7:15. He brought up frogs with it in Exodus 8:5. He smote the dust, and the dust became gnats in Exodus 8:16. He stretched it out toward the heavens, and the hail fell on the land in Exodus 9:23. He stretched it out over Egypt, and the locust came in Exodus chapter 10, verse 13. He stretched it out over the Red Sea in chapter 14, verse 16, and the sea parted. He had just recently smote the rock with it in the earlier verses in this very same chapter when the water was supplied out of the rock. It was a symbol of God's presence and a symbol of God's power and assurance of victory given to them. In plain sight as the battle raged, that they were going to be victorious. But this time he did not stretch it out. He did not hold it out toward them. He did not stretch it out like he did over the sea when the waters parted. Something different with it. He held it up. Verse 11. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. That brings us to the second aspect of encouragement. You know, our presence is very important when somebody needs encouragement. I'm reminded of Job's friends in Job chapter 2, verse 13. Remember when they came to him after all of Job's losses? And his friends just came and gathered around him for, I think it was 7 days or something like that. And they never said a word. They were really good encouragers up to that point. When they opened their mouth, they kind of, you know, blew the whole thing. You know, their encouragement wasn't very good at that point. But they did quite well as long as they were just there. Well, God is there for us, and we should learn the lesson. We should be there for others who need encouragement. And sometimes it's not at all what we have to say. You ever feel like, I don't know what to say in this circumstance? That's okay. You don't have to know what to say. But you do have to be present. And you do have to pray. And that's the second thing we see here. When Moses raised the staff up instead of out, there is an indication here of his connection directly with God Almighty above through that rod. So not only do we encourage others by our presence, but we encourage them also through prayer. There was an indication that Moses was completely operating as God's messenger, as God's leader, as God's man, and he wasn't the one providing the victory. It wasn't Moses that caused things to go well on the battlefield. It was God, because the rod was held high to God. I think everybody on the battlefield caught the significance of that. Moses was praying for them. As long as he held the rod up, they prevailed. Now, I don't know what instruction Moses had from God other than to do this. Maybe he thought, well, you know, my arm's really getting tired. I'll let it down for a few minutes. I don't know if it happened that way, but if he did, at the moment that happened, the tide of battle began to change. And God was going to honor the prayers as long as the prayers were offered and as long as the rod was held up so all that could see that it was God Almighty that was providing the victory. We're told in James 5 and verse 16 that the prayers of a righteous man avails much. That has always been the case and it always is the case. Prayer is one of the greatest encouragements that we can offer to anybody. Now we as Christians and fellow church members often say to each other, I'm praying for you, or I will pray for you. I assure people in the hospital, like I did Miss Jackie yesterday before her procedure, that there's a lot of people praying for you. There's comfort in that. But it is so common for us to say those words, and it is so easy for us to intend to carry them out, and yet at the same time, forget, fail to stand in the gap, and offer the intercession that needs to be offered. I urge you, do not just say you will pray for someone, but actually do it. Make a commitment. Now, the only way I can even begin to do this is I have to write it down. If I tell you I'm going to pray for you, and I don't write it down, I know the chances are good I'm going to forget to do it. That's why if people are going out the door shaking hands and someone mentions a prayer, I'll take out my bulletin and write it down immediately because 5 minutes from now, I may forget it. I want to be held to that commitment. From the bulletin, it'll go to a prayer list. And hopefully then, everything will be all right. We need to follow up, too. We not only need to pray for other people, but we need to go back to them, or as we come in contact with them later, that should come to our mind, and we should ask, how is the situation? How are things going? How is the circumstance that we're praying about? That becomes a real encouragement. It's one thing to tell somebody, I'm going to pray for you, and for them to say, well, that's great, but if they never hear back from you, they are going to assume you weren't really that serious about it. So follow up. We encourage others by our presence. We encourage others through prayer. Let's go a step farther. We also encourage others by persevering. And what I mean by this is that we have to persevere in our effort to encourage. We have to persevere in the sense that we have to be there for them. Presence. We have to pray for them. Intercession. And whatever else we need to do. As we persevere in the act or the specifics of encouraging someone, that begins a snowball effect. It's good to be encouraged at one moment, but it's better to be encouraged again, and better to be encouraged again and again. We are not people that typically just need a moment or a brief word of encouragement, and then we're good to go. If we are really, truly discouraged, we're going to need more than a little bit. When Moses' hand and the rod came down, the battle went against them. Why did it go against them? Was it just God just allowing the enemy to have the victory? Or was it those soldiers couldn't see the encouragement? I don't know. Maybe a little of both. The scriptures don't always give us all the ins and the outs. But I know one thing for sure, if you were in that battle and you were down in that valley and you were in the midst of the heat of the conflict and you looked up and you can't see Moses with that rod up, You might be more than a little distracted at that moment in battle. Your fears, your doubts might come to the fore. But as long as you were there in the midst of that battle with a sword drawn and your immediate commander could say, fight on! Move ahead! Attack! Look in the mountain! Moses is praying for us! God is with us! The rod of God is there to see. If you could hear that from your fellow soldiers, you would be spurred on, encouraged, to the point of confidence and valor. So there's an importance to the perseverance, to the aspect of perseverance in regard to encouraging others. Encouragers need to persevere. Not only do you as an individual need to persevere in your encouragement, but the people you are trying to encourage, or the person you're trying to encourage, they're going to need multiple other encouragers too. Because again, one short word will probably not prove enough. Good encouragers encourage other people, but great encouragers encourage other people and encourage other people to encourage other people. Good encouragers live, breathe, and die encouragement. And if you find a person like that, you stick close to that person. And you learn. And then you become that person as best you can. But encouragers are often overworked because there's so many that need encouragement. It's not unusual for encouragers to become discouraged. They want to encourage everybody and help everybody, but not everybody responds and not everybody is encouraged as they should be. And the greatest of encouragers can easily become discouraged because of the immensity of the task. And in regard to the response of those that they deal with. And so they need help. Let's look again. Verse 11. And so it was, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, the Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. So he took a stone and put it under. They took a stone and put it under him. At this point, verse 12, they've come to understand the rod of God needs to be extended upward. But Moses is not a spring chicken here, okay? He spent 40 years in exile. He was probably, who knows, 30 or 40 before he went into the exile. Now, he's an old man. At least 80. And he can't stand there all day on his feet on that rock. And so, Aaron and Hur, they find a rock, move it in place, or direct him to it if they couldn't move it, and they allow him to sit down on the rock. So he's seated and supported. His hand still has to be lifted up. That's where we're at in verse 12. But Moses' hands became heavy. After a while, it wasn't, you know, they realized it's got to be extended, but you can't hold your hand up with even an instrument of a pound or two or three for so long. So when his hands, you know, got heavy, the rod of God would sag. So they took a stone and put it under him. That's what he sat on. And he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands. So, if we could imagine Moses sitting here on a rock, such as that chair, obviously just seeing the picture, Aaron and Hur stood on each side and literally held his hands up. So he was supported as far as his arms were concerned as well. And we see in this picture the importance of encouraging the encouragers and assisting them in their work. Again in verse 12. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Consistent perseverance in encouragement is required. And that oftentimes takes a team of people to accomplish. You will never accomplish the task if you set out to encourage someone, if you're not willing to pay the price of persevering in that encouragement. Some of the most discouraging things you'll ever deal with if you try to encourage people is to find them in such a state of mind that they literally refuse to be encouraged. And it is so easy after a while to just say, it's no use. It's no use. Can't do anything with them. If they just want to stay down there where they're at, I can't do anything more with them. That's when the true encouragers have got to persevere. Other people have got to get involved. Hands have to be supported. The rod of God lifted up. Prayer put before God. But the reason so many people stay discouraged and they're in that state of mind where they don't feel anybody can do anything for them is because they don't have enough people gathered around them to hold them up. They don't have enough people. They're supporting them as a team. That's why you and I need a lot of friends. And anytime we isolate, there's a tendency when you get discouraged is to isolate yourself from other Christians. Why? Well, Christians are not supposed to get discouraged. We're supposed to be people of faith, right? Who wants to go broadcast to all the friends? You know, I'm a lousy Christian. I'm down in the dumps. I'm discouraged. I'm defeated. You know, it's just easier just to pull yourself away and hide somewhere in a closet and not admit it. And by that action, you are depriving yourself of the encouragement you so desperately need. It's like somebody who's dying from lack of thirst going out to the desert and complaining. I mean, you're doing it even to yourself when you do that. Now listen, some folks have problems with discouragement and depression for other reasons than poor choices. Sometimes there are physiological causes, physical reasons. And in certain cases, they may need some medical help. But I guarantee you, if that's the case, they also need all the psychological, all the supportive friends and real Christian encouragement to go along with it. Encouragers need to persevere. So be an persevering encourager. Number four, encourage from your perspective. You encourage others by your presence. You encourage others through prayer. You encourage others through your perseverance in the matter of encouragement. But the content of what you say, again, better to be present and say nothing than to say the wrong thing, like Job's friends did. But we do need to have some content that we communicate, some truth that we use as the basis for our encouragement. So we encourage from our perspective. Now, obviously, the implied here is that we have the right perspective. Let's look at it again. In verse 13, we're told that Joshua defeated Amalek and the people, and his people with the edge of the sword. Now let's take up in verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book, and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. And I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Why do you think God told him to write it down? Because this would not be the last time that Amalek would be a thorn in the side of Israel. And it would be a great number of years yet before God made good on that promise that He makes here that eventually Amalek is going to be completely wiped out. And in the intervening time, they're going to have to know of this promise. There's going to have to be a recording of it. There's going to have to be a recounting of it and a refreshing of their memory So the battle that was won that day became the basis, the foundation for tomorrow's encouragement. You see, if God can do it here, He can do it here. If God can handle Amalek here, then He can handle Amalek over here. And eventually He's going to completely and utterly handle Amalek. It is as we gain perspective on the power of God and the faithfulness of God that we really then have a story to tell of God's encouragement and God's faithfulness. So Moses builds an altar, and he builds an altar, and he calls the name of the altar Jehovah Nissi, which means the Lord is my banner. Now, when I get a chance, I like to read about Civil War battles and strategy. I don't know, it's just I like military history. And I've always been intrigued by the fact that going back to the Civil War, the regiment's colors was always so important, and I never really fully understood that. And if the man carrying the colors was shot or wounded and he went down, somebody else would pick up the colors, even at great risk of life, to make sure the colors were held high. I always just thought, well, that's just some kind of antiquated, commitment to loyalty or something. No, it was more than that. I actually did some research and found out this use of colors in battle goes all the way back to, guess where? Ancient Egypt. From where Moses had just come and where Moses had been trained. The colors specific to each regiment indicated the position of the leader, the commander. And it gave reference to the soldiers out on the periphery of the conflict to know at all times where his regiment was located. I mean, you know, they didn't have modern ways to communicate. And so it was very important for positioning in battle and for knowing where you should be and where the lines were and all that. And Moses doesn't say, okay, here's my colors. He doesn't make a colorful flag or standard, you know, that brings any attention to himself. He just builds an altar. And he says, the Lord, He is the banner. He is the commander. He is over us. Why the association? The colors, the banner, the altar. But for that message alone. Perspective on that day's victory. Perspective for tomorrow's challenges. I'm reminded of what we read in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 1, beginning at verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort, who comforteth us in our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. Every challenge, every trial, every problem, every situation, every circumstance that brings us down, everything that beats us down, everything that discourages us in life, as we draw upon the comfort and encouragement of God, whether it comes to Him, to us directly from Him through His Word or through other people, as it is lifts us up, as it encourages us, it helps us to develop a mindset, an outlook, a perspective on life's problems that we then can share with other people that brings about the same effect in their life. Be an encourager. Be an encourager. It is so absolutely important. St. Mary's School, Morris, Minnesota, according to a story the author Alice Gray. This actually happened. It's a Catholic school. Sister Helen was the teacher, junior high class. The class was struggling with some aspect of math, judging from junior high and math, probably algebra. And the children were frustrated and so forth, and she was frustrated as the teacher. So on that day, she said, put away your math books. Get out a sheet of paper. She instructed them to write on that paper the nicest thing they could say, the one thing, the nicest thing they could think of to say and say it in regard to every other classmate in that schoolroom. They did. The class's whole attitude and demeanor changed. She took the papers home. She collated them and then gave all those positive comments that came from all the other class members. She gave that one page with all those comments as she rewrote it, transcribed it, gave it to each student. So each student had the one thing that every other class member in their class said was the thing that they most admired about them, or was the nicest thing that could be said about them. Changed the whole perplexion of the academics of that moment. But then, 6, 7, maybe 8 years later, don't know the exact time frame, Sister Helen learned that one of her students, Mark Eklund, had been killed in Vietnam. She went to the funeral, as did a lot of his former classmates. After the funeral was over, Miss Helen and the other students were standing around Mark's father, who pulled out a piece of paper. He said he had taken it from out of Mark's wallet. And there it was, that sheet of paper he'd been given so many years before, still on his person when he was killed. Folded and unfolded many times, a lot of tape holding it together, but there it was. All the good things his classmates had said about him. And if that wasn't enough, the students, his fellow students standing around said, "I still have mine." One said, "It's on my dresser drawer." Another said, "I keep it with me all the time." Another said, "It's in my diary." And almost to a person, they all had retained that sheet of paper. Encouragement is that important to people. And if it's that important to people, and if it's that important to God, then it ought to be important to us that we be encouragers.